Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. It's 9:23. The 19-year-old shooter who killed 17 classmates and teachers in Parkland, Florida, had no diagnosed mental illness, but people had noticed his unusual behavior. In fact, the police had been contacted. The shooter had been seen by a therapist. People spoke out. So as there are calls from the president and others for more attention to mental health in the U.S. as a way to stop mass shootings and for people to speak out if they think someone is a danger, we're going to talk to two mental health experts about how we diagnose mental illness and get people treatment. My guests are John Snook, he's executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center, and Dr. Amy Barnhorst is the vice chairwoman of community psychiatry at the University of California, Davis. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question about mental illness and how we get help, call 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. And I'd especially like to hear from people who've tried or succeeded in getting themselves or someone else help for severe mental illness or who work in the mental health profession here in Minnesota. Again, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Dr. Barnhorst, I want to start with something really basic. Let's start with how do we determine whether a mental illness is severe or not? When people keep talking about, oh, they're very mentally ill and we need to get them help, but what qualifies?
Yeah, it sounds like when we say severe mental illness, we're just talking about a spectrum of how bad it is. Mm-hmm. But generally, we use that term in the research and treatment community in psychiatry and mental health to denote certain mental illnesses that often confer a more severe impact on people's lives. So as an example, if you considered everything that was in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, where we do our diagnoses and our criteria and our coding from, if you considered everything in there a mental illness, you would be including things like caffeine intoxication and certain sleep problems. When we talk about severe mental illness, we're talking about things like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, severe depression, things that have such a serious impact on people's lives that they're oftentimes not able to care for themselves, not able to seek out treatment, sometimes are not aware of what's right and what's wrong, what's real and what's not. So we're not just talking about anybody who, you know, shows signs of psychological instability or anger problems. We're talking about people who have a serious diagnosis.
And when people are brought to you and you have to determine whether they have a severe enough mental illness to be, I guess, put in a hospital without their consent, how long do you have? What happens? What's the process that you go through?
Well, so I work in a crisis unit, and it's sort of like the equivalent of an emergency room for people in a psychiatric emergency. And so folks come in, usually involuntarily, because those who don't come in involuntarily, they often can seek help on their own elsewhere. But people are brought in by the police or by their families, and my job is to determine whether or not I have the ability to admit them involuntarily to a psychiatric hospital for further treatment. And in California, where I work, and this is similar in most states, they have to be either a danger to themselves, a danger to somebody else, or gravely disabled, meaning they're not able to provide for their basic needs like food, clothing, and shelter. And it has to be because of a mental illness. So as an example, just because somebody's homeless and doesn't have the shelter, but if they're not mentally ill, they wouldn't actually qualify to be on an involuntary psychiatric hold. If somebody gets in a fight with their partner and says, I'm gonna do something bad to them, and they make a threat of violence, but it's not because of a mental illness, it's just because they had a bad argument. Again, that wouldn't qualify them for an involuntary psychiatric hold.
John Snook, I want to know if we have find somebody who has a severe mental illness and they need help, are there enough resources for people? Are there enough beds? Are there enough doctors? And do we have the system we need that, you know, President Trump would like to see? Speak up, identify people, and then what would happen? Is there enough room for them?
Unfortunately, that's an easy answer. No, we don't. Across the system, in basically every sector that you would look at to see how are things going, we're simply failing. I think these sorts of issues that we see on the news when these tragedies happen, the discussion is often focused on how didn't this person get care? And I think it's important that we try to flip that discussion and think about the fact that these sorts of incidents are rare, but even these sorts of situations where we have folks who are really sick and really in need of care, even then the system isn't working. And so for everybody else who's trying to get care, they're struggling even more. And I think that's something that gets lost in these sort of more polarized discussions is just how broken it is for folks every day trying to get care.
Doctor, how long, when you see a patient, how long do you have to determine whether they should be involuntarily put into a treatment center?
Well, there's different limits on the time. So, for example, when you work in a crisis unit in California, there's generally a 24-hour limit where you have to make a decision and move the person off the unit one direction or another after 24 hours. So they either can be discharged back to their home in their community or admitted to a hospital. They're also initially, from the legal perspective, the first hold, again, this is in California, is a 72-hour period. So generally, somebody could be held involuntarily for 72 hours, not necessarily on a crisis unit, but that gives you some time to really evaluate them, get to know them, talk to family members, collect collateral information before you make a decision.
Going all the way to an emergency room or calling the police seems so extreme, but I know I called our, we have a number here at our company where you can call to get mental health services, and I had a someone close to me who needed just some help, and I was hoping to, like, you know, when someone needs some help, usually you can, like, if they need a haircut, you can make a haircut appointment,
right,
force them, drive them, and like, we're going to the haircut right now. But I could not make an appointment and say, I've got you an appointment, and now we're going.
Yeah.
You know, that was not okay. And I was wondering how you deal, if you feel like somebody is a danger to themselves or to others, do you have to call the police? Do you have to go to the emergency room? Who do you call before they have to see you, Dr. Bernhorst, in a real acute situation?
Well, it's a tricky pathway, and it's, you know, it's different in different counties and different states. But where I work, there's a couple different ways to do it. So if somebody's, you know, become potentially dangerous or violent at home, families can bring them in by themselves if they feel safe doing that to either an emergency room or a crisis unit. We also have a mental health urgent care here in where I work. And then also the police can get involved, and police have the ability to detain people on an involuntary hold. Also bring them either to a crisis unit or a psychiatric emergency room or a regular emergency room. And that's kind of the portal into emergency care. But unfortunately, like John mentioned before, we are so strapped on all levels of mental health care that if you're trying to just get an appointment because you ran out of your meds or you're just having a really bad day and you need to talk to somebody and you go through the regular non-emergency pathways, oftentimes people are told, you know, it's a 3 to 4 month wait to get into care. And that's not what they want to hear. That's not what they need.
Let's go to the phones right now. Angela in Minneapolis has a question or a story. Hi, Angela.
Hi. I have more of a testimonial, but I knew I was mentally ill from a very young age, and I reached out to my mom and my school and tried to seek support. And it wasn't until I was an adult suffering from alcoholism that I actually received some care. And so at that level, when I was in treatment, I had the discussions and I had the care that was able to be provided to me. And I was really upset and saddened by the fact that it had taken so long and so much to get the help that I needed. And it wasn't that I hadn't reached out between being a child and being an adult and in treatment. I had. And I think that some of my alcoholism came from not knowing where to go. I had to either be suicidal, ladies and gentlemen, honestly, suicidal, or ready to hurt someone else in order to receive care. And it was terrifying, honestly. And when you're talking about this and you're talking about what an epidemic and what a difficulty it is to get care, you're absolutely right. And that is a huge problem.
Thank you so much, Angela.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's not only a problem for me. I'm now close to 40 years old, and I have meds, and I'm doing so much better. But still, I have a child. I have a husband. I have a job. Mm-hmm. And not everyone understands mm-hmm. mental illness. I can go to my boss and say, hey, I'm having a rough day. They don't understand, and they want me to keep working.
Thanks you so much, Angela. Her story is really moving, and she's someone who reached out as a child, as you know, in school. Is there especially when you're looking at a really young person, you know, when we're talking about these school shootings and someone pushed to an extreme, where's the support in schools, and can they do more beyond teachers having guns? I was thinking more about guidance counselors or nurses, or is that where we should start? John, how about you?
Well, one of the biggest and hopefully most salient issues that I see that has been an issue for, unfortunately, decades is the lack of engagement and understanding of when, especially severe mental illness, when those breaks occur. All across the country, one of the things that we see, and when you talk to young people, they say, well, I could tell something was going on with my friend. I just didn't know where to go. I didn't know what mm-hmm. to do. And I was part of the Virginia Tech panel after the tragedy there years ago, and I really haven't seen much development, improvement in those issues. And I think that's really a concern, and that's an easy place. Colleges should be one of those spots that we say, we know from the medical evidence, this is when those first breaks often happen. This is when we really need to be engaged. And unfortunately, it just doesn't happen in the way that we would for any other illness. And we lose a lot of people. And I use that term deliberately. We lose people simply because we don't provide them care at that first break, that most important moment. And it isn't necessary.
Dr. Bornhorst, how do you determine if you think someone is going to have a break, or if you have the instinct that they might, but you really don't feel like they're mentally ill? What do you do?
Well, I think there may be two different ways the word break is being used here, because I think what John was talking about, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, was people who have the early stages of schizophrenia or have a psychotic break, or they start to show signs of a serious mental illness.
Exactly.
And that does often strike around college. Mm-hmm. And so I think that colleges are particularly well poised to intervene on people who are beginning to show signs of serious mental illness, because early intervention we know is better. And that is just the age when things start to happen, is the late teens to early 20s. But there's a different kind of break, if you want to use the same word, where people, they snap, as the vernacular goes. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something we need to consider separately from all of those people out there not getting the mental health care treatment for their mental illnesses that they need. These, some mass shooters probably do have serious mental illness, but it seems that there are many, if not most, who are really acting from a place of anger, of resentment, of entitlement, none of which really are at a level that qualifies them as seriously mentally ill. And while nobody could make a cogent argument that those people are actually, you know, some paragon of psychological well-being, it's really hard to treat them in the mental health system. They don't seek out care through the mental health system, and they often don't fall into the net of the emergency mental health system because they're not impaired enough in their lives to qualify for some sort of involuntary treatment. So I think that in terms of that kind of incident, it really is the earlier interventions in high schools, maybe even elementary schools, wraparound services with families, giving them support, intervening with kids who are having social problems, getting psychologists involved at a much younger age. And I think there are some counties that are doing this now, just really intervening with what appear to be troubled kids in school. But part of the trick is, even if everybody knew Nicholas Cruz was going to snap one day, there wasn't a lot that could be done about it to prevent it.
Yeah,
and that's really where I think there's a big gap.
I remember I worked on a story years and years ago about a couple who knew their son was going to, something was going to end badly for him. Mm-hmm. And they could not get help because he had not done anything violent. Yep. And he ended up dying in a police shootout. He was on a freeway and was acting unstable and threatening people with a gun. And he ended up being shot himself. Mm-hmm. And the parents had asked for help again and again.
Yeah.
What could we do to change it so that people can get, if, like, once your kid turns 18, and you don't have the same rights over them as minors because they are adults. What needs to change to make sure that people can get the help that they need when someone does not want any help like that?
If I can jump in, there's
go
one
ahead, John,
piece.
Yeah.
This is obviously one of those pieces that I think both Dr. Barnhorst and I are excited to get in on because there's just so much there. I think one of the biggest things is, again, the stigmatized idea that the way to provide medical care for an illness, which mental illness is to determine if someone is dangerous or not. And thankfully, many states are starting to move away from that sort of either-or discussion of how you provide care and say, well, let's treat this. It's a brain illness. Let's treat it like stroke. Let's treat it like other illnesses and say, is this person able to make a treatment decision? Are they starting to deteriorate? Are they able to understand what's going on and their need for care? And if they're not in that position, let's try to provide them care until they get to a point where they are, again, able to sort of participate voluntarily. And what we hear, we take calls from families all over the country, is families say, you know, I knew my loved one was sick. This has happened over and over again. He stopped taking his medication. He stopped showering. He was talking to himself. If we could have gotten him care a month ago, we knew we would have been able to get him back on track. But everyone we called said, well, he doesn't sound dangerous. You say, well, who cares if he's dangerous or not? He's sick. And if he was having a stroke, you wouldn't say, well, it sounds like he's having a stroke, but let's wait until he hurts himself really bad and then we'll get him care. It's ridiculous, but it's how we provide care for the mental health system.
Mm-hmm. Can we take care of a patient like that on an outpatient basis, or do you need to get a hospital bed for somebody?
Well, that's what's really tricky, just to piggyback on what John said, is that folks can be very ill, but oftentimes with medical illness, if you're very ill, you know you're ill, you want care, you seek care, and you accept care. Not always, but much more generally. With mental illness, part of the illness is denying that you have it. So the sicker people get, oftentimes the less they want care, the less they're willing to accept care, the less capable they are of seeking out care. So for example, the patient John just described, you're not going to see that person dialing around, calling up their insurance company to figure out their complicated mental health plan, calling up different offices to see where he can get an appointment, filling out all the paperwork. I mean, somebody like that is not going to be capable of initiating the incredible logistical efforts that you have to do to get into an outpatient appointment. But on the flip side, to get people into care involuntarily, you are taking away some of their liberties. And so it's a question of how low do we want to put that bar of whom we can hospitalize involuntarily?
Okay, we should probably take some calls because we got a lot of people waiting here and I'm feeling bad. Let's go to Karen in St. Paul. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I want to name that there are a lack of emergency psychiatric beds in Minnesota. I have reached out to get a bed when I've needed one, and I live in the Twin Cities, and the only possibility has been Fargo, which is far from my family and support network, and I can't do that.
Thanks, Karen. That's an important point. And I want to back up Karen's feeling, the anecdotal feeling that there aren't enough beds, with some statistics here. So Minnesota, there's a study about how many psychiatric beds were available. And this was this number is the beds per 100,000 people. So it makes accounts for differences in population. And Minnesota only has 3.5 beds per 100,000 people. And some place like D.C. has 40, over 40. Hawaii has 14 beds. Idaho has 10 beds per person. Wow. We seem to have a big lack of psychiatric beds available here in Minnesota. Is that what we need, is just more places to have people to go?
I think that's definitely right. And one of the complicated factors is what are we calling a bed? Mm. So Minnesota is a little different than a lot of states in that they specifically eliminated all or most of the state hospitals to try to provide more community-based beds. Unfortunately, I think there'd be very few people who would argue that Minnesota has kept up the amount of beds they actually needed to have that work. There was a study a couple of years ago that said there were basically a fifth of the people that were in the inpatient facilities in Minnesota that were ready to be in the community. There just simply weren't any places mm-hmm. for them to go. And so the system gets backed up. One piece that I think the federal government, as they're having these discussions, could help fix is that there's a provision that's basically just stayed on the books because no one cared from the 60s that said Medicaid, the sort of common funding source for a lot of mental health treatment, isn't allowed to pay for beds for inpatient psychiatric care. And we just have never bothered to take it off the books. And what that means in a state like Minnesota is you're not going to be able to build enough beds because you have to pay for it entirely with state money. And so you end up in these sorts of situations where families say, you know, I can't have the only place I can get care for my loved one be 2 hours away. Or law enforcement say, I have to drive someone across the state in order mm-hmm. to get them care. They're spending the night in jail instead. That's just an easier and better way to deal with this situation.
Why is that Medicaid law on the books? Was that to try to encourage people to be treated outpatient so we didn't have as many people? Because we had a lot of people in mental institutions that were very poorly run in the 60s, and they want to move to those community mental health centers. Was that the
exactly.
reason why? Okay.
Yeah. And so this is one of those things. It's called the IMD exclusion. It's just a really good indicator of how little we've paid attention to mental illness. Obviously, we needed to change the way things happened then, but to say that's when we stop really our science was the 1967. We know so much more. Our treatment systems are so different now. And so to have that law just sitting there preventing people from getting care, the requirement says you can't have more than 16 beds and get funding from any federal government for those beds. So what you see across Minnesota and across the country are these very small 16-bed facilities that don't make enough money to really make them economically viable and really can't provide the level of care that you need because there just aren't enough psychiatrists to man all of these many small facilities all over the state in an effective way. It's just mm-hmm. a really inefficient way to provide care.
Let's go to the phones again. Kathleen in Minneapolis is waiting. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there. Yeah, you know, I just want to talk about or just say something about the fact that when there are school shootings, mental illness is becomes such a huge focus, and there's already such a huge stigma against mental illness. And I'd like, even this program, it's not making me feel very hopeful or even address the fact that people with mental illness, it's just another disease. And I wish we'd
exactly.
hear that. And it's just, you know, it's, so anyhow, that's what I want to say.
Thank you so
reduce
much, Kathleen.
Reduce the stigma and work to reduce the stigma.
Yeah, there was a survey a couple of years ago where they asked people who needed some kind of intervention and help why they didn't seek it out. And over half of them said they just wanted to take care of it themselves. Like, and imagine if you said, you know, I'm having a stroke. You know, I'm not going to go in. I'm just going to take care of it myself. What do we have to do to change our images of mental illness and make it seen let people see it's an illness that could be treated? Doctor?
Well, I think one of the first things is that every time there's a mass shooting, to not put all over the headlines that the person was clearly mentally ill when there's nothing to support that. And I think it's really hard not to slip back into that narrative. But every time something horrible like that happens, the mental health system gets all this attention. And the association that people have is, well, of course, this person must be mentally ill. Of course, the solution is to have more beds, do more with the mental health system. Meanwhile, people with mental illness out there are trying to get beds themselves, trying to get care themselves, and finding more and more roadblocks due to stigma. Like, nobody wants to have a small psychiatric hospital or a residential treatment center in their neighborhood because aren't all those mass shooters what mentally ill people look like? So I think the putative association between the perpetrators of that kind of violence and mental illness is really damaging to just regular old people with mental illness who are trying to seek treatment.
Here in Minnesota, I mean, tonight they're going to be voting in there's a suburb of the Twin Cities, Forest Lake, and there is a developer who wants to put together a facility that would provide mental health resources for kids from 7 to 17, and mm-hmm. the community is against it, and they might not be able to pass it. Is one of the roadblocks, like, there's just no place to put these facilities? And how is there anything we can do to change it so they could be a little bit bigger? You know, 16 isn't that many. Should we reinstitutionalize ourselves in some ways?
It's a hard question to answer because, again, it's that balance between getting people into treatment and also preserving people's liberties. And I agree with what John said. Having those 16-bed units scattered all over any state is really efficient and really inefficient. But it would be great to have a lot more support for things like outpatient residential programs, support networks, a resource center like you're talking about. Having more services at a less restrictive level for people that are much more accessible, being able to get in to see a doctor within a week or a couple days if you're in a crisis without having to go to an emergency room, all those kinds of things to really bolster up those mid-level supports would, I think, be really helpful. But yes, oftentimes there is a stigma against people not wanting those kinds of facilities in their neighborhoods, unfortunately.
And when you're filling out forms, like medical forms for insurance, like life insurance, and they ask, you know, have you been diagnosed or sought mental health treatment in the past 10 years? You feel like it's a pejorative. You feel like it's going, if you do go see somebody, it's going to affect your work life. It could affect insurance rates. It feels like feels like it could ruin your life rather than improve it. Am I crazy to think that? I shouldn't use the word crazy. Am I wrong to think that? That people feel like it's scary to reach out because it'll follow them around forever?
Not at all. And I think one of the things we see is, just as Dr. Barnhorst said, none of the things we're talking about in terms of reforming the system are that complicated. I think if you would step back and take mental illness away and add any other illness into what she said, having a continuum of care that provides the right sort of care at the place you are when you need it, it's a pretty simple proposition. Unfortunately, we just haven't done that for mental health. And so people very much think of that person who's homeless, who's talking to themselves, when they think of mental illness. Because the system has failed so many people, that's our mindset.
Rachel in Minneapolis is on the line. Rachel, hi, you have a story?
Hi, yes, I'm a gun violence survivor, and I am troubled that the NRA has been so effective at pushing these conversations toward mental illness after these mass shootings happen. We need to do a better job raising our young men. The best indicator of who will perpetrate a mass shooting is being a white male and having a history of domestic violence. So combating this toxic masculinity and white privilege is really the most important thing in these situations.
Thank you so much for your story, Rachel. Dr. Barnhorst, are these people mentally ill, like these mass shooters? Or, you know, to use a really old-fashioned term, are some people just evil? Or what is happening? Because people say you obviously must, and people use terrible pejorative terms. They must be nuts. They must be crazy.
Right.
They must be a lunatic. What is happening if it's not a mental illness?
I mean, I agree somewhat with what the caller said, which is that this is a sort of a personality that gets formed over years and years, and it is much more common with younger white males. But again, I haven't treated any of these mass shooters as patients, so I can't know for sure, but most of them really lack a significant mental health history or significant symptoms of serious mental illness. Oftentimes there has been some depression, some anger problems, bad behaviors in school. They've seen a counselor, maybe been expelled, maybe been prescribed something for ADHD or depression. But that describes so many young men in our country.
Yeah.
So it's easy to look back and say, oh, hey, this guy showed all those signs. But if you look forward and you look at all the people who also show all those signs and you talk about for example, rounding them up involuntarily in the mental health system, you're going to need to build a lot more beds. So I do think that it's not – whether or not you call it mental illness is something of a semantic issue, but the larger question, at least for somebody like me who works on the front lines of the mental health system, is if you're going to call it a mental illness, it should be something that the mental health system is in a position to intervene with, that it's something we can actually treat and get better. And also, maybe more importantly, that if we're going to rely on the mental health system as a pathway for firearm disqualifications, that these people might actually meet those thresholds to land on a prohibitory list. And most of them do not, because the firearm disqualifications that are tied to mental illness involve getting pretty deep into the system.
Let's take one more call. I think we can fit it in. Mary from Red Lake has a good question to, or a good statement to wrap up the show. Mary. Are you there, Mary? Doesn't sound like Mary is there right now, but she said that there are mentally ill people reaching out to the system and the system isn't working. And she says people in the system are not doing their jobs and there's gaps between being able to get services. And I was wondering if we have, even if we didn't put more money in and hire a bunch of new people, if we could just make the system work a little more smoothly, would that take care of a lot of this? What do you think we need, John?
Well, it's hard to say exactly how you would make the system move more smoothly when it's so fundamentally broken. I think there are some major steps that need to be taken. At the end of the day, things like mental health parity, ensuring that doctors receive the same sorts of reimbursement for providing this sort of care that they do with any other illness. Those things just simply aren't happening throughout the system. There are too few psychiatrists. But I think at the end of the day, the most important thing that we're seeing is something that's hopeful. We are starting to get to the point that people are taking, especially serious mental illness, are taking these issues seriously. And we're starting to recognize that we can't just have a system where law enforcement becomes our de facto treatment providers. We're starting to move away from that idea. And I think we're on the cusp of doing something really important here. It's just taking a lot longer than most people would hope.
Dr. Barnhorst, I was wondering if you can give us any idea of are we getting better at treating mental illnesses? Are medications keeping up? Do we understand enough about how our brain is working? And is there enough money going toward that too?
There's a lot of great research going on in psychiatry, and I think one of the interesting things about it is how much there is to know about the brain, and I don't know that we'll ever be able to fully understand the brain by using the brain, but mm-hmm. It is a fascinating field of research, and we are making advances. There's so many new medications out there. I think more importantly than having new effective medications, what we're having are the same old effectiveness with medications with fewer side effects, but, mental health is a really interesting field to be in because there's so much more involved in the treatment than just the medications or procedures like there is in other fields of medicine. Mental health involves families, communities, residences, homelessness, substance abuse. There's so many other aspects of it besides the medications. And I think what's really been a missing piece is for us to pull all of those things together into a network and have them work well for people on a very individualized level. And I think that somehow magically being able to do that, as well as having more resources, more psychiatrists, more inpatient beds, that would be what would really help the mental health system.
John, if you know somebody, if we know somebody who, even if they're not close to us, a neighbor or a classmate who seems like they could be seriously troubled and could hurt themselves, where do you even start if it's not your own family member?
One of the nice things we're seeing in states like Minnesota and around the country is as those 911 calls are happening, they're starting to provide a combination of both law enforcement response and a medical response, moving away from that idea that we're just going to have the police respond when someone has a mental illness. Where we're at now, unfortunately, I think that's where the call needs to start. I think you need to either call a local mental health agency or your local law enforcement, call 911 and have that discussion, because you don't want to be in a situation where you haven't provided someone that level of care when you knew there might be something that they needed.
Thank you both so much. I mean, this is a super complicated issue and really emotional, and it's important to have these conversations, and we'll probably have many, many more. But Amy Barnhorst is vice chairman of the community psychiatry at the University of California, Davis. She's in Sacramento, and John Snook is the executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center, a mental health advocacy organization in D.C. Thank you both. Have a good day.
Thank you, Stephanie. Too.